John Dunn, microphone on. All right, well, I appreciate you all coming by. This is a session that was added to the list relatively recently, so I really appreciate you guys finding out even where this was. So thank you very much for coming. So I'm between you and lunch, so I'll bear that in mind. We will not run long. This session is going to be best practices for Solaris containers and VMware infrastructure, and specifically, kind of cutting to the chase, it's do containers and ESX play well, and if so, how do they play well? So we're going to kind of explore the agenda. We're going to use this phrase, OS virtualization. I don't know if you've heard this phrase used or not, but we're going to kind of explore what that means, and specifically how containers, and then within containers, how zones actually work. The point of the conversation is actually the latter part, is the explanation of use cases and trying to map certain problems onto certain technologies. And it would be kind of nice just to jump right to that and spend an hour working on that. The problem with that is that there are some subtleties of the technologies that may not necessarily lend themselves to figuring this out on our own. So I could just say trust me, but I don't think we know each other well enough for you to actually trust me in this case. So hopefully by the end we'll have laid a foundation to do that. Now, in physics, there's this interesting problem. In physics, there's a thing called consider the Earth a sphere. And I don't know if you've ever heard that phrase, but consider the Earth a sphere. You know, if you try to describe the mechanics or the orbital mechanics or some of the things like gravity on Earth, it's really, really nice if you just consider the Earth a sphere, because it makes the problem really, really simple. But the problem is, in simplifying the problem, we lose some of the interesting details that lead us to maybe some inaccurate conclusions about things. And applying consider the Earth a sphere to here is sometimes conventional wisdom says, well, if sun's involved, the answer is containers. If sun's not involved, the answer is ESX. And what we really want to do is explore the fact that it's a much more complicated situation than that. And I don't consider it an or proposition. I consider it an and proposition. And what I want to do is I want to look at where we would use the technologies for solving the problems in their best light. Okay, so some background to start the conversation. First of all, I'm going to assume that you already understand the VMware technologies, particular ESX. So we're not going to go spend a lot of time and talk about that. I'm going to also assume that you have at least some interest, desire, or knowledge about Solaris, but probably don't have a whole lot of detailed information on Solaris zones. And the danger of that part of the conversation means that this is going to be, the first part of this is going to be a whole lot of what's really cool about Solaris. And I'm sorry about that, but that has to kind of lay the foundation for the part we're going to do at the end. So I kind of apologize for that up front, but this is going to be a kind of what's cool about Solaris discussion. So if that progresses too terribly long, throw something at me. And as I said before, I'm going to make the observation that I believe that these are truly complementary technologies, and I don't want to go pit one against the other, because pitting one against the other means that we're going to have some capabilities or some optimizations left off, and I don't want to go do that. So what I want to do is unlock the lock, and let's go demystify some of this. Okay, so what is this thing about OS virtualization? What does it really mean, and how does this differentiate between other things that you might have seen out there? And OS virtualization really is a virtualization of the user space. What we're trying to do is give every user space a view that they're running in their own environment. So what we've done is isolated user spaces from each other, but yet we maintain a common kernel space across all of them. And what this does is it gives us a tremendous opportunity to optimize and share across things, share across user spaces where that sharing makes sense. So what this is an incredibly lightweight virtualization layer. And we like it from that perspective, because if it's a lightweight virtualization layer, then potentially we could have lots and lots and lots of those. Now, we actually discovered how many of those we can have. There's a particular device driver that instantiates itself every time a new zone gets created. And that device driver has an 8192 instance limit. So that's the number of zones we can have. So we can have 8,000 of them. So this is monstrously scalable technology. Matter of fact, and the weight of them is so light that you might consider deploying every single application in a Solaris situation in their own zone. The layering is, in fact, that light. And really the trade-off there is, do you run out of IP addresses? That's more of a concern than the side effect of deploying lots and lots and lots of them. The value that we return back is, with only one real kernel set of things to manage,
And that's really where you spend a lot of your difficult time setting up, building, and maintaining a system. There's only one of those per box, so I don't have to go do those functions over and over and over and over again. Like, so for example, if I go through all the difficulty of setting up IP multipathing or storage device multipathing, I only have to do that once. Everybody else gets to inherit those properties, but yet we get to take full advantage of them. So it's not like you get inheritance by abstraction. You actually get to see them, touch them, optimize on them, but I don't have to go configure them every single time. So that turns out to be a very, very cool thing. As a matter of fact, that then becomes the basis for one of our use cases at the end. Okay, so now we've heard the phrase Solaris containers. We've heard the phrase Solaris zones. And one of the things that's interesting is, what are the two? Are they the same thing? We use the terms, unfortunately, interchangeably, and are they the same thing? And the answer is no. Solaris containers is actually a broad umbrella, and if we rip the word containers apart, we're going to find that the root of the word container is contain. So containers is actually all about resource management. So it's about being able to place limits on applications in boxes. Now, we've had this kind of in the past. Where it becomes a little bit more interesting in the Solaris 10 case is that we've added a new capability, and that new capability is partitioning and isolation with zones. So if we kind of go back and look historically, we've had a very good fair share scheduler. We've had very good workload management. But the challenge is that the workload management has been either cumbersome or difficult to go encapsulate a whole bunch of uncontained stuff. It's very, very nice if I can go identify everything that's going to run, but ad hoc workloads, it hasn't been particularly easy to use. And so in Solaris 10, with user space partitioning through the zones technology, what I'm able to do is now add ad hoc controls to those resources. So it's very, very cool. Now I can say, I can go take a bunch of stuff, put it in a user space, and I don't care what's in that user space anymore. That'll all get accounted. That'll all get limited against the same set of limits. And those limits are dynamic and very easy to control. So I like that. So the trend in the OS is to move away from static limitations and start moving into virtualized user space controls. And these now become project limits rather than etc system parameters. The impact to that and the big deal about that is rebooting even for changes in system parameters is kind of becoming a thing of the past. So we really like it from that perspective. Okay, so the components of Solaris containers are workload identification. So that would be things like projects and tasks. So that's a way to go label workload. And I can label individual processes themselves. That's kind of historical. The nice thing here is I can label a zone. So I can now say a zone has a project name, and I can apply limits to that project name. I can apply guaranteed minimums against that project name, and I no longer have to be involved in the specific details of how that zone is configured. So if somebody wants to go start another Oracle SID in there, fine, that SID gets applied against the resource limits. And that turns out to be very, very important when you begin to look at software licensing. And so the ability to go control everything and label everything within a zone turns out to be a very important limit for workload management. In addition, I've got lots and lots of workload management tools. Now, most of these are historical. A couple of them are fairly new. The memory cap daemon is new to Solaris 10 with respect to zones. But most of these we've inherited all along. What we've done is just made the integration with zones easier, made it a little bit more interesting. The interesting part about zones, though, and in order to really explore what's interesting about zones, is zones run in a reduced privilege mode. Now, that reduction of privilege turns out to be very, very important because that's part of the security barrier that's going to prevent workloads in one area from affecting workloads in another. And so in order to explore that, we have to kind of explore the Solaris 10 privilege model. Okay? All right, let's look at it this way, and we're going to come back to this. So Solaris 10 security model is different than we've seen in the past. The Solaris 10 security model is no longer based against two classes of users. There's super user and everybody else. So for all intents and practical purposes, you know, the kernel doesn't check for user ID 0 any longer. What we've done is we've gone to a rights-based privilege model, so we've defined a set of rights. And these rights are now granted to processes, or they're not granted to processes. And so what that means is that if I compromise a user in a Solaris 10 world, then you only compromise those rights that user has. So it's kind of cool. I can take something like Apache, for example. If Apache is running in Solaris 10, I can give Apache the right to create privileged ports. Now, historically, that's why Apache, at least the base Apache, has to run as user ID 0. In a Solaris 9 or other environment, if Apache is running as user ID 0 and I compromise it, I'm now user ID 0 on a box, which means I can write all over the place, I can control, I can do all kinds of other nasty things. This Whereas 10 world, the only thing I could do is create additional privileged ports. And while that's not necessarily good, it's not horrible from the sense that I can't use it to escalate my privilege to go do other things. Okay? So the Solaris process rights turns out to be a very, very important component of understanding how zones, in fact, work. So if we look at this list, and I've got an eye chart coming up here, and this eye chart, I apologize for this eye chart, but I don't expect any of you to be able to read that, but what this is a list of all of the Solaris privileges. And there are, I think, 48 on the list of the last time I counted. Now, what's interesting about this list, and I've gone and tried to color code them for their applicability to zones, is on this list of 48 some odd privileges, there are a bunch of things that you cannot do in a zone. Now, if we had a lot more time amongst ourselves and we had some opportunity to go explore this in detail, I might quiz you on this. As a matter of fact, if I had some really cool giveaways, I'd probably quiz you on this and try to have you deduce the list. But here's a rule. If you stick with this rule, you can reproduce this list on your own. The rule is that if I've got the privilege, then I can either detect or affect another zone. So if I can detect or affect another zone, then I don't get that privilege. So if I look on the list, I look at something like proc lock memory, for example. If I have the proc lock memory, what could I do? I could do a real memory denial of service attack against another zone, right? I just continue to allocate and lock memory. What happens is I get more and more physical memory. That poor zone over there gets less and less and less memory, and eventually I create a starvation denial of service attack. And the rule that we use today is that's not really a good social thing to go do. So while we use it internal for stress testing and Solaris, that's not usually a good thing to do. The challenge with that is there are applications that might want to do that. And if those applications that want to do that are not allowed to do this in a zone, then the question becomes, are zones a not applicable solution for that problem? And so in addressing that, what we've done is we've gone in and said that in Solaris 10.11.06, we're now going to allow you to configure the list. So I've decided that this is the secure list. This is going to be the list by default. But in Solaris 10.11.06, I'm going to allow you to configure the list. And so if you want proc lock memory, cool. You can have proc lock memory. You can run Oracle in a non-global zone. You can have it lock its SGA in memory, and it can deliver the kinds of performance. It's not going to go emit the error messages that it emits today. You can do that. The odd one on the list, that's on the list, oddly enough, is systime. And I'm still trying to figure out the use case of why I would allow a non-global zone to change the system clock. So if any of you out there can figure that out, please let me know. But it is on the list. It is a configurable privilege. And you can have non-global zones set the clock in Solaris 10.11.06 if you want. The most important, though, list of privileges up here are the detrace privileges, which is going to allow users now inside a non-global zone to dynamically trace applications. And that's a big deal because this whole security model is based on not having users or developers up in the global zone. Then the ability to run detrace in a non-global zone turns out to be phenomenally important. So that's really the rationale for configurable privileges. Okay, processes are separated in zones. So when I do my OS virtualization layer, since everybody's in their user space, this is really what we're talking about. We're talking about process isolation. So in many respects, we used to call this Hotel California. Once you're mapped to a zone, you can't get out. So the zone is a sticky binding, and you're unable to see other people in other zones. So if I look at an example of the output on the screen, this was a PR stat run from a particular zone, and notice all I saw was, and the list was a little bit longer than this, all I saw were the processes in my zone, and I saw my resource consumption of my zone. I do not see anybody else, so I do not know how many zones are in this box. That's the unique perspective from a non-global zone. So in this respect, slash proc is completely virtualized. Every zone has their own slash proc, and we only show you the things necessary. The global zone, on the other hand, gets to see everybody. So had I run this command from the global zone, I would have seen every process in the system. In addition, I would have also seen the resource consumption by zone at the bottom as an easy summary. Okay, so the global zone gives me a unique perspective. That turns out to be important, particularly when I look at things like debugging multi-tier applications. IP, now this is interesting. So IP today is mostly a kernel thing. And as we said, there's one kernel in the system, right? So that means then there's really one IP thing in the system, and so that's an important part of the design. So there is one IP stack, there is one set of tunables, there is one set of filters, And so we all share that. From the non-global zone's perspective, this is phenomenally important because I'm denied visibility into other devices and other routings that I haven't been given. As a matter of fact, if we kind of look back at the picture we had before, there was a picture that I had I wanted to go explore. So if I look at this particular picture as an example of a non-global zone, kind of notice at the bottom here I've got some network interfaces. If I can get my laser pointer to go fire up over here. Oh, there we go. All right, so if I see I've got three network interfaces down here, so I've got a Happy Meal and a couple of Cassinis. All right, so notice that this particular zone has a IP address here, but it does not have an IP address here. So there is absolutely no way for applications in here to be able to communicate out the Cassini Zero. All right, now let's begin to kind of piece together the implication of that. What if, for example, a very common case is Happy Meal Zero, since this is the slow LAN, Happy Meal Zero, this might be my internal management LAN. These might be outward-facing, high-performance public IP addresses. Well, notice that none of these non-global zones up here have interfaces on Happy Meal Zero. Oh, I'm sorry, this guy does. But if I took those interfaces away, then those zones would not be able to communicate out on the internal management LAN. The security implications that are tremendously profound, right? That means I have no way to get there. So that means if I go hack one of these things, then I can't go up and just start sniffing around on other networks that I haven't been given. So that's a very, very important part of the security model. So that's security through detail abstraction, and that's a very, very big thing. Okay? It also means that the non-global zones themselves cannot set their own firewall rules. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they can't have firewall rules. It just means that that's a thing that has to live in the global zone. So I can go create firewall rules. Anything that has an end destination address can be, in fact, snooped and controlled from the global zone. Okay? Devices and file systems. Every non-global zone has what it thinks its own root file system, its own set of directories, and its own set of devices. Now, these are given by the global zone. Now, what's interesting about this and what separates this from other VM technologies is that these are all visible in one big, gigantic namespace. This has a huge implication at the end when we talk about things like backup and restore, because what this means is there's no private state inside a zone. So everything that the zone is doing, every activity that the zone is taking on is observable from the global zone, and so I can audit it, I can control it, I can apply resource limits, I can back it up, and I can restore it, and I can do that from a single vantage point. So from that perspective, I can have kind of any number of these, and my basic administration of these is fairly constant because it doesn't really matter how many non-global zones I have, I back them up the same way. Okay. We're going to talk about the implication of file system naming in just a minute, but let's look at devices. I can give devices to zones, but the devices have to be somewhat safe. So, like, for example, if I give you DevRandom, all right, now there's probably going to be one security person here that's going to talk about clashing up of the seed space out here, and I'm not going to go down that path. But I can give DevRandom to every non-global, and, you know, can I hack DevRandom to do bad things? Absolutely not. So that's safe to give. But giving DevIP would be a horrible thing to do, right? Because if I give DevIP to a non-global zone, boy, I can go in and start looking at the network stack, and I can do all kinds of bad things. So there are certain devices that I cannot give to a non-global zone, and that's done for security reasons. But one of the questions becomes, if you're a DBA and you happen to like raw devices, I can give raw devices, and they work the exact same way as in a non-zone case. Okay? D-Trace, now this is a big deal. This is actually a tremendous thing, and any of you who have done development and tried to do debugging of multi-tier applications, this is going to be huge. One of the things that I can do, and one of the interesting use cases for non-global zones, is I can now build a multi-tier application. I can have a database tier, I can have business logic in a tier, I can have presentation services in a tier. But what's interesting now is I can look at all of them from one vantage point. And I don't have to deal with things like clock skew, which is a huge complexity, to try to figure out, all right, so this happened, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened. I actually get to watch all of them from one place, and since we're all working off the same clock, then I can very safely debug because I understand the synchronization of events, and I can see those all from one perspective. So zones and D-trace, in fact, work together incredibly well, and for those of you that have to be D-trace knowledgeable, one of the things that we've done is we include zone name as a built-in dtrace variable, so I always have access to my zone name. Plus, I also give you, in the proc data structure, I give you the zone ID out of the proc data structure. So those are things that you can use to go do aggregation or identification of and debugging techniques within a zoned environment. Now, one of the things that we can't do today is today we cannot run dtrace in a non-global zone, but we're going to change that. We're going to allow you to run dtrace in a non-global zone by granting dtrace prop and dtrace user privilege, and now your developers can safely run inside a non-global zone. We think that's going to be incredibly cool. I also apply resource limits, and one of the things that I do here that's a little bit interesting is I take advantage of the fact that the Fair Share Scheduler is a multi-tier scheduler, which means that I can aggregate a bunch of resource limits, and within this big, big aggregation of resource limits, I can subdivide it yet once again. And so the typical model here is I'll do a very, very high-level aggregation for non-global zones, and then within that non-global zone, I'll allow the root user in there to go carve up those resources as that non-global zone user sees necessary, and that's kind of cool. In addition, I also support processor pooling, so processor binding, as a way to go limit resources. Now, so what that means is I get a picture that looks a little bit like this. Now, this is a very common use case, and you know, if I go back and look, this here is your typical 8-way server, and this is a very common case where I've got over here in the no parking zone, what if I've got a database application, something like Oracle running over here? If I can go find it. So we've got Oracle running here. I've got other workload, I would consider this as almost like junk consolidation workload here. And then I've got my global zone. I need some stuff to go run me because if I'm getting in doing management things, I don't want to be denied CPU resource. So I might come up with a common carving that looks somewhat like this. Now remember, this is all one kernel space, but these are separate user spaces. Now, before Solaris 10, we would have to license every single ISV application in the box to 8 CPUs, right? Because there is no way that you could look at a ISV and say, you know what, I can guarantee that license enforcement is taking place. So you'd have to license to the maximum number of CPUs in the box, and so what that led is that software licensing costs were higher than your usage, and that's not a good thing. Where Solaris Zones changes this, and where Solaris Pools change this, is you can now talk to an ISV with absolute certainty that if I'm in the no parking zone running Oracle, and that Oracle is mapped to pool B, the mapping of that pool is completely hidden. The Oracle zone has absolutely no knowledge that that pool mapping takes place. And what's the thing is if I can't see it and I can't touch it, I can't change it, right? So even as a root user, I can get in and I can create a new SID. I can create as many SIDs as I want in there. I'm still going to be limited to those 2 CPUs. So from a ISV licensing perspective, that's a huge deal. So that means in this case, I only have to license 2 CPUs for Oracle. I can take those other 4 CPUs for my junk workload. I've got 2 over there for me, and I only have to pay the proper level of usage, and I get auditing in one place. So when I begin to look at things like software audits, it's very, very convenient because I can look at this from one place. So I can kind of sleep at night knowing that even a developer at 2 a.m. isn't going to go violate the licensing agreement. Now, kind of a little bit beyond the scope of what I was going to cover, but this also creates another interesting use case that we haven't seen before, and this is this notion of CPU sparing. What if, for argument's sake, in this 8-way box, what if CPU 6 and CPU 7 fail? So, I don't know what led up to the failure, but if CPU 6 and CPU 7 fail, what's interesting is, does that zone crash? No. The zone doesn't schedule because there are no resources left in its pool to schedule, but the zone is still there. The address space is still loaded. It's still doing its thing. And so what I can do is I can dynamically bring over maybe CPU 1 for me, because I really don't need to do my job, do I? I was just doing that because I was greedy. So I bring CPU 1 over, and I bring CPU 2 over from the other pool, dynamically bring that into pool B. Pool B is back up to its proper resource limit. It's now, and everything is back running. And what I haven't lost is I haven't lost network connections. If I do this quick enough before anybody wakes up, nobody ever knows that this happened. So in many respects, I've created a hot sparing model for CPUs, almost like we have for disks in a RAID array. This is kind of cool. And so this magic that's delivered is part of a fault management architecture. I'm not going to go into detail on how that works, but the use of zoning makes this all, in fact, possible. Now, I've got a 12-year-old daughter. I like to use my daughter as a lot of examples in the industry, and she's, you know, she's got a good sense of humor, so she doesn't mind when I do it at least too terribly much. This kind of almost looks like something that came home from her math problem the other day. And this advanced mathematical formula is helping us go look at how the Fair Share Scheduler works within pools. So if I look at the previous picture and I've got four pools up here, and of course I'm going to do the best thing in the world, is I'm going to change the names on you so that you can't figure out from place to place, but for the purpose of this argument, no parking zone is running Oracle, it's bound to two pools, or two CPUs in its pool, and it's now known on this slide as pool two. What I'm able to do is, in addition to the hard cap that's established by this, I can also write, in addition to that, a minimum usage rule that says, you know what, within my cap limits, then I can guarantee that this pool gets at least this much resource. Now, what's interesting about this is I can do it at a very, very high level. So, like, for example, in my global zone, I'll say, well, my four pools are set up with one share, three shares, one share, and two shares. So I get this very, very nice even number of seven shares. So I grant 2/7 of the system resources to zone the kind of the bluish zone there, and I'm done. From the global zone's perspective, from the administrator's perspective, I'm done. I don't have to get involved because it does not take my privilege and it does not take running in the global zone to go further subdivide that non-global zone. So I now turn the job over to an application administrator in that zone. Say, all right, so now you as application administrator, you go carve it up the way you see fit. And of course, naturally, we don't communicate, so they chose another even number of 22 shares. So if we do this advanced math, what we've discovered is that that little project database up there gets approximately 8% of the total box. Now, I can adjust my limits to meet certain service level agreements, and then that user within their zone can adjust those limits. Those limits are dynamic, and they are, in fact, they combine very, very nicely. So what that allows me to do is write guaranteed minimum rules. I can write guaranteed cap rules. This is very useful for ISV enforcement. This is very useful for service level agreement, and they play together very, very nicely. Now, unfortunately, it would be nice if zones were a thing. It would be incredibly easy. But in fact, zones are not a thing. I've got two different kinds of zones. In fact, I'm going to throw you a curve because I'm going to say there's a third kind of zone, but I'm not going to talk about that one today. So I'm going to talk about two different kinds of zones. There is something called a sparse root zone and something called a whole root zone. And here is exactly the difference between the two. The difference is that in a whole root zone, you've got a complete copy of every file in the system. If you've got a sparse root zone, we inherit all the files in /user/lib/platform/sbin. And if you talk to me, you'll also inherit /opt. Because I think Opt is a tremendous candidate. So if you're beginning to build your best practices rules over here, number one is if you're coming down the path I want to come down, is I would add /opt and try at all costs to make /opt an inherited package directory. Now we'll see during the installation process the impact that this has, but the difference between a sparse root zone and a whole root zone is whether or not you've got shared files. If you've got shared files, though, the runtime implication is tremendous because if I know that you and I are sharing read-only a set of dynamically loadable libraries, why do I have to have two copies of them in memory, right? So if I'm using inherited package DIRs, then all of the shared libraries in lib, and this could be useful for ISV applications if you follow my rule, and /opt is an inherited package DIR, all the dynamically loadable libs in /opt are all shared. So what that means is then I can reduce the VM pressure because I don't have to keep duplicating shared libraries over and over and over and over again, which means I can use a smaller memory footprint, and smaller memory footprints are always a good thing because potentially with a smaller memory footprint, I might be able to squeeze down to that next smaller memory size, which means then I can use less expensive memory in the configuration. So this is all kind of progressing down towards why this is in fact a good thing, and this is why we aggressively share. Because of this, I make the recommendation that sparse root zones are your first course of action. Question?
I guess what we can also get, before you talked about global zones and non-global zones,
right.
You talked about sparse.
Well, these are the types of non-global zones. I apologize. These are the types of non-global zones. These are, yeah, from this point on in the discussion, we're now talking about non-global zones. And so there are two types of non-global zones, so I apologize. Those two are sparse root and whole root zones. And the only difference between them is whether they have their own set of files, their own set of system files. Now, unfortunately, if everybody in the universe had read the Unix style guide, as a matter of fact, if everybody knew that a Unix style guide existed, the Unix style guide says that you should not write in /user. As a matter of fact, you should be able to have a Unix system mount/user read only, and the system should continue to function properly. How many have actually tried that? As long as you load Solaris, you're going to be fine. But you start loading third-party apps out there, or you start putting a whole bunch of things in /user. How many of you have an SSH daemon that writes the key locations out in user local lib? That's very cool, right? You go get something from BlastWave or from one of the open source repositories, and you do that. All of a sudden, now I violated the rule. So now you're going to say, but if I inherit /user, then that means I can't use a sparse root zone for that kind of problem. The answer is no, and we'll see some techniques for getting around that. But if you've got somebody who sprays all over /user and you can't contain it to a single directory, then you have to create something called a whole root zone. That's not like having the bird flu, but it isn't necessarily a best practice. So a whole root zone, now instead of having 200 megabytes for my zone, I now will duplicate all of the system files, which could be as much as 3-4 gigabytes. And so now my zones are becoming a little bit heavier. The amount of time it takes to install it are becoming a little bit higher. And if you've got a writable shared library, can I trust you any longer so I don't share libraries in that particular case? So your VM pressure begins to go up just a little bit. VM, virtual memory, not virtual machine. Okay? Now, this is one that doesn't seem to be well known and understood, and this is that patch and package management is fairly automated in the presence of non-global zones. And so one of the things that we do, and this is one of the reasons why non-global zones don't scare me, is it makes maintenance a whole lot easier. So now if I apply a patch to the system, what happens is that patch gets applied in the global zone because that's where it has to be. And then systematically, one by one by one, we walk through each non-global zone and we check to see if that patch is applicable. And if that patch is applicable, then it gets applied. So what this really means is I don't have to patch each individual zone one at a time. Now, one of the things that I look at is if I go look out at an enterprise, how many of you are actually running every single system at the exact same release and patch level? Very few. You've got either an innovative environment or a small, brand new environment. It's very, very hard to do, isn't it? Now, I sit back and say, is the reason because patches are bad? We can make that statement. But the reason is because patch management tools have let us down. And it's really, really easy to go fall back in the category of, well, you know, if it doesn't hurt, then don't do that. So because my patch management tools have kind of let me down a little bit in the past, then I kind of proliferate, and I'm not going to go patch what isn't broken. And, you know, you do this over 10 years, and you end up with 100, 150 different patch levels, and that makes things incredibly complex. So one of the things that we're looking at, the automation of patch and package management through zones is going to allow us to have fewer and fewer sets of patch levels, which is going to lead to less complex environments and more reliable environments. So this is an area where I think we're actually kind of beginning to rein in some of the difficulty we've had in the past. Now, to administer, and this is where it gets interesting, is I only need to know three commands to go survive zones. Zone config, zone ADM, and the login. So this is only going to make sense to the Solaris folks who are already doing this, but there's only three commands necessary to make zones happen. Zone config is how you configure them. Zone ADM is how you administer them, turn them on, turn them off, install them, delete them. And then Zlogin is like SSH for a zone, and it communicates over a private loopback. And what's interesting about Zlogin, because I'm using a private loopback, and because that private loopback already exists before the zone exists, then I can actually use it to get into a non-functional zone and fix a non-functional zone. So I don't even have to rely on it coming all the way up. I can get in and fix things, and that's a very, very important part of dealing with zones in this kind of an environment. Okay? Now, the installation process goes something like this. So I create a zone configuration that defines all of the zone properties, IP addresses, file systems, inherited package DIRs, and the like. So we'll assume that that already exists. So now it's time to go create this thing. So as I said before, each zone has this notion of a root file system kind of off to the side. So we've got to go build this thing, right? And so the way we build it is we look at the global zone contents file. So in other words, all of the files that were delivered to the global zone via packages. So we've got this in one big file. It's actually called the contents file. You can go find it. It's not real hard to go find. So we take a look at the contents file and say, all right, so these are all of the files that need to exist in the non-global zone. Here's where we have to make our decision. If I am inheriting files, do I need to copy them? The answer is no. So then I look to see if I have any inherited package directories, and if so, I remove them from the list because I know I'm going to get them via inheritance, so I don't have to go copy them. If I'm using a whole root zone, I don't have an inherited package directory, so if I got a whole root zone, then I'm not taking anything away, right? So I start off with this list of, I don't know, 1.5 million files, and then in a very aggressive sparse root zone, I'm going to get rid of all but about 2,000 files. So I now go copy those 2,000 files. Now, what's interesting about those 2,000 files is I get them from a place that is not from the ones that are editable and changeable, like the host file, for example, the password file. Those actually come from a copy that we tucked away off to the side. They don't come from the global zone. So it's kind of like you get to start with fresh copies of everything. Okay? So I copy these 2,000 files, 1.2 million files if I'm a whole root zone. And then I go one by one by one by one, I go through package add, package add, package add. Now the reason I do that is that I've got pre-install scriptlets, post-install scriptlets, and it's unbelievably important for me at the end of this to keep my package database sane because I may go apply a patch to this sometime later. So now you're going to say, but you know, that's an awful lot of work to go make this happen. Absolutely. But if I don't do this, then my zones become less sane, which means maintaining them long term becomes very, very difficult. I don't want to go do that. So I do go through a little bit of work here. The end result of this is for a whole root zone, I've now consumed an additional 70, 80 megabytes in general. If you've got a lot of packages, you could consume, you know, 100, 120 megabytes. If you've got a whole root zone, then however big your Solaris cluster is, you now have two of them. Okay? So that could be anywhere from 3 to 5 gigabytes depending on what you've installed. Okay, so now armed with all of this information, then let's begin to progress towards some recommendations. To me, the only time to use a whole root zone is when I cannot contain writes to a manageable set of directories. And to me, manageable is like this many, right? So it's 2, 3, 4, or 5. If you're installing something that writes a little bit here, writes a little bit here, writes a little bit here, writes here, sparse root zones are not your game, and we have to go deal with that, and that's just a trade-off. But notice, for example, let's look at a development case. So in a development case, I've got a Java developer that says, oh, I want to have my own set of user Java, and it's got its own stuff. Well, I can drop in a user Java in a non-global zone. I can even do that from the outside. So that would not be an example of what I'm talking about. Okay? Another time when I would use a whole root zone is when I want to test patches against shared components. So like, for example, if I've got a patch coming in for libc, libc is a drastic patch to the system. I might want to apply a little bit of regression testing before I just simply proliferate a libc patch. That seems like a good idea. So what I might do in that scenario is I might create a whole root zone, apply that patch, do my regression testing, be satisfied that nothing broke, and then apply that patch to the global zone, and then everybody gets the update. In that case, I want to use a whole root zone because I don't want the shared copy patched. Okay? So there is a use case, but I would not necessarily consider that a good persistent use case for a whole root zone. The rule of thumb is use a sparse root zone unless the situation deems itself non-manageable. The second question about zoning is how far do we go take this? I told you can have 8,000. Now, are you going to go home and carve up 8,000? No, you're not going to go do that. As a matter of fact, if you run out of here thinking I can go create 100 of them without a plan, I'll stick around. I'll cancel my flight tomorrow. I'll stick around. I'll start a session, a therapy session for you. So let's approach this thing very, very cautiously. But the point is that it's not going to go fall apart after 5, 6, 7, 10, 100, 200. So one of the questions you're going to have is, do I put one application in a zone or do I put multiple applications in a zone? And you know what? The answer to that question turns out to be incredibly easy. There are two cases where I would put two applications in a zone other than IP pressure. And if you've got IP address pressure, we've got other things that we can go look at, like network address translation and ways to go deal with that. If the question is how to zone, then the question becomes, is there a performance advantage in sharing memory? So an example of this would be a database, and then the application is going to go hit the database. Do they perform light years better if they can communicate via shared memory versus IP? And if they do, then the answer is yes, and I go stick both of them in a non-global, in the same non-global zone. If the answer is no, if I'm not getting breathtaking performance or a huge reduction in resources, then I'm going to go ahead and separate them, and I'm going to put you in a non-global zone, I'm going to go put you in a non-global zone, and you communicate via IP, because I get too much upside for doing that. The other case would be one where I want to have a single administrator, so I'm going to call this the security administrative domain problem. If I've got one security administrator or one application administrator who I want to go manage five or six applications, it might be easier on my side to say, I'll tell you what, I'm going to give you a zone. Here are all of your applications. I grant you this restricted root access to this non-global zone and have at it. It may very well be easier for me. It may be more efficient from my perspective. It's a little bit of a cop-out. But it may be more efficient from my perspective to say, I just create one non-global zone and you now create your applications the way you want. So that kind of goes against this one application, but the benefit here is that otherwise I have to go create a whole bunch of them, and if it's the same user set over and over and over again, you know, maybe there's optimizations to be had by that. So my number one decision is, do they benefit from shared memory? Number two is, does it make it easier for me if I minimize the number of administrative domains that I have to go grant root user to? Okay. Now this gets us to the point of the conversation. So now we've kind of got some formulation of how we would zone, how we'd go collect up things in a zoning environment. Now the question becomes, how does VMware and containers, how does this all fit together? All right, so I said this is what you were here to hear, and I hope we've got some background now, so when I go make the claims, it all makes a little bit sense. All right, so the difference is, are you doing ISA-level virtualization, or are we doing OS virtualization? Because the question is, are we trading off flexibility for performance? So I use VMware when it, and this is kind of the obvious use case, when I'm trying to support heterogeneous operating systems, because until I do a little bit of magic, zones are only a Solaris thing. So if I'm trying to do Solaris and Linux and Windows, you know, the zones is neat, but it doesn't really help you much because I can't create a Linux zone, at least not yet today. I can't create a Windows zone. I doubt that we ever will. So if I'm trying to do heterogeneous operating systems, game over. Zones is neat, but this is not the place you need to play. And as much as I'd really like to stand up and say that everybody should be running the exact same version of the operating system, there are times when running multiple versions of the operating system just becomes too darn difficult, and it's now time to do ISA-level virtualization and get out. So if I'm trying to support multiple operating systems over a very, very long period of time, there's nothing in the world like ESX, and so that would be the recommendation there. So there we're using efficiency and flexibility over some other things. Live migration is another deal. If I'm running an application and I want to take advantage of things like live migration, zones do not migrate live. I just do not do them. It's very, very hard to go take a part of a kernel that's running and just go hand that to somebody else and say, hey, can you start running this part of this kernel for me? It doesn't work like that. So if I need to migrate things live, again, I'm going to, if that's the Trump value, then this is an ESX play, and zones become kind of an interesting aside. On the other side, though, when I look at if I want very, very fine control of resource limits, so if I want subdivision of CPU and I want to be able to easily observe that, then I'm probably going to go down the containers case. So if I'm going to go try to, and we do this in benchmarking an awful lot, one of the ways that you achieve tremendous performance in benchmarking is I try to go put all the workload in one box, right? Eliminate the network. But when you do this, you have to be able to throttle certain workloads so one doesn't overrun the other. So being able to control how much CPU usage something like a database gets, which then allows my application servers maybe to get ahead of the difficulty, is a tremendous thing. So if I want very fine control of resource limits, I'm probably going to opt down the zones case and the containers case rather than a VMware case because I've got tighter controls and more flexible limits. This is one where this kind of becomes a huge Trump case from our perspective. We've done an awful lot of work on things like hardware telemetry. But if I'm trying to take advantage of very advanced features in the operating system, and this is one of those where you don't like to say this, but there are going to be some times where the technology inside the bare metal operating system turns out to be more valuable than the virtualization limits. And so if you're trying to leverage default telemetry in FMA, if I really, really, really like the ability to dynamically trace a multi-tier application, then what I'm going to do is I'm going to steer towards a containers case because that turns out to be the higher order bit. Now, In the case of FMA, that's one of those where maybe that says that bare metal provisioning for that particular problem is in play. But at least for the case for ZFS and DTrace, I can play with that with VMware as well, so those technologies are available under ESX, so it's not like I lose those capabilities. And then another one is the performance envelope. And the performance envelope, one side is pretty obvious, and I've heard a number of sessions talk about this. When you begin to look at tremendous high-performance workloads, particularly on the I.O. side, you tend to want to go run bare metal. So, for example, Oracle is going to run incredibly well if I go lay it on top of an operating system that has advanced I.O. features like Solaris. So that would be a case where an Oracle in a domain, an Oracle in a zone might be a tremendously good idea. The one, though, that is the wild card is the exact opposite side. And what if I've got just a very, very lightweight widget? A web server is an example. I've got a tremendously lightweight thing. Maybe I don't want to bring an entire VM environment just to go support a very, very lightweight object. So I actually look at the performance side on both sides and say that, if you're Six Sigma on one side and Six Sigma on the other, then bare metal is probably where you want to be. However, then that gets trumped by the fact that very frequently in heterogeneous environments, you have to deal with the fact I've got OS dependencies that can't always go be simply eliminated and consider the Earth a sphere. Okay. So I said before, here are the container spec practices, and we're going to jump into the use case. Container spec practices, you said before, are use sparse root zones until you can't, use whole root zones only when you must. I'm going to change my opinion on this as I learn more about ZFS clones, but for right now we're going to stick with that. Group applications into zones by either shared memory requirements or by administrative credential domains. Use loopbacks to share data unless I'm going to migrate them, not live. If I do believe I'm going to migrate zones from box to box to box, then I want to use NFS as my sharing transport because then I don't have to change the zone configuration. I just plunk it off one box, drop it on another, and I don't have to deal with moving its data. And that's an incredibly important thing. Okay? This one is controversial, and so you can yell at me if you want on this particular point. Run file backup from the global zone. Do not run it from the non-global zone. This is going to go against a lot of practices, and the reason for that is you would run backup in a non-global zone if there was some specific state that you're trying to capture or some particular thing you're trying to change in order to make the capture of the data safe. Well, what's different about zones and other virtualization techniques is everybody is visible to me, right? If everybody is visible to me, then what private state exists down that non-global zone that I can't capture from the global zone? So my recommendation here is to run backup and restore from the global zone, not run it from the non-global zone. Now, those people who sell software licenses, sometimes get frustrated when I say that, but this is going to lead to a little bit less complex environment. Okay? And don't run anything in the global zone you don't have to run. The global zone is not an application server, right? Because if it's an application server, it can be hacked, right? And if it can be hacked, remember, you're now running at full privilege, which means I can do very, very bad things. So only run the services in the global zone that you must run. Almost treat it like a hypervisor. It's a minimum set of services. There's a management layer, so SSH. I maybe run intrusion detection. I run hardware error reporting, and I run accounting and backup, but that's it. I don't run any other services because then those services actually belong in a non-global zone. So, use cases. Go now bring this and apply this to the subject at hand. Use case number one, web server consolidation, okay? At Sun, and I'm going to make up these numbers, but they're probably not terribly far from true. At some 30,000 employees, we probably have 45,000 web servers because one of the things, it's our inalienable right as an employee to create a web server. So for every employee, there's 1.5 web servers, probably half a Twiki, a couple of PHP DBs. And so there's this mass proliferation of content delivery vehicles within our environment. Now, what do we know about all of those? All right, I maintain 5 web servers myself. I look at the web logs. Those things are unbelievably underutilized, and they are tremendous consolidation candidates. But why haven't I consolidated them in the past? Because it's too darn difficult, right? Because what happens in this environment, and let's look at the characteristic of this, and we're going to use this as an example to say there's an awful lot of things that fit into this category. There are very few OS dependencies. I've got a Solaris 9, 2 Solaris 10s, a Linux, and something else, and a web server. Why? Just because they were that way at the time. They don't have to be that way. So very few OS dependencies. But the problem is that they all want to live on a known port, and I really, really, for my sake, is I'd all like them to live in the default location so that when I patch them, things go very, very nicely. Okay, so enter Solaris zone. So let me look at this another direction. If I don't have OS dependencies, then I would be very, very tempted to say that bringing along a VM to support, 2% of a CPU is probably not a smart thing to do because I'm bringing more resource into it than I need. So in this case, this is a great use case for zones. So I would now map this to say zones and put each web server in their own zone. Now, what do I get out of this? Everybody lives on port 80 because my IP port spaces are all unique per zone. So every web server lives on port 80. Well, that's the environment I got now. That's the environment that I've got that I'm going to have when I go do this. More important than that, though, is if you look at the mechanics of the web server itself, all the configuration files now live in their default location. Every web server's configuration file is scapachehttpd.conf, right? If I try to consolidate them any other way, one of them is the default name, and then the other 99 are off in a different place. Now, if I've got a new hire sysadmin, it might be fun to go send them off, go find all my configuration files, document it, and then just go change it on them. And that's how we haze new sysadmins, but that's not an effective way to run an enterprise, albeit a fun way, but it's not an effective way to run an enterprise. So, but more sinister than that, all right? That's difficult, but more sinister than that is here comes a patch for Apache. Patch for Apache comes in the mail. Now, I now want to apply it. In the case where I haven't done zone-based separation, I apply it to one, and then I have to manually adapt the patch to the other 99, don't I? Time-consuming, problematic, and I'm going to say, probably isn't worth the effort. Okay, so zone solves an awful lot of problems for this. And it's tremendous. It's very, very good when I've got a set of cookie-cutter applications all want to live in the same location. I want to simply automate them. So this is a very, very easy use case. Okay, I'm going to switch to use case number three next. Use case number three is what I call ERP in a box. Now, this is different than just an ERP landscape. When I'm going to say this is ERP in a box. Now, is this a useful use case? Absolutely, because you know what? Every ERP developer would love to have their own ERP in a box, wouldn't you? If you were doing development in a multi-tier ERP environment, I would love to have every single component, assuming that licensing allows this, I would love to have the entire landscape in my box so I can go run them. Do I care about performance? No. As a matter of fact, in this case, I'm trading off performance against flexibility because then I don't have to have all the server sprawl to support a complete infrastructure. The advantage I get out of this is because now all the pieces are where they're supposed to be. The things that I develop and test turn out to be more reliable because I get better test coverage, and that's a really, really good thing. Again, this is hard because the realization is not all components run on all operating systems. Now, we can sit back and have the competitive discussion all day long, but the simple fact is there is going to be some legacy interface, there's going to be some component that doesn't run on my operating system, no matter who my is, that's going to be the case. So in this case, I love ESX for solving this problem. I go carve it up, and I go deal with it. So in that case, then what I would do is I'd use ESX, carve it up into multiple domains. Then each virtual machine runs a separate operating system. Now within that, I'm going to say, you know what? This ERP in a box is eventually going to map itself on top of a ERP landscape, a real ERP landscape. And in that scenario, Oracle or Sybase or DB2 or whatever it is, notice I'm leaving off certain databases that don't run on Solaris, but once those databases land, they're probably going to land on bare metal inside a zone, so then I would probably take one of those big Solaris VMs, and then I would use zones with ESX to give it the same kind of landscape that it would end up with in its bare metal provisioning sometime later. So this is a tremendous opportunity to go tie all of these technologies together, and this is a very, very common use case. This one is a little bit more difficult. This is one where, you know what, I could go both ways on this one. This is what I call the Web 2.0. Now, there are two ways to look at Web 2.0, and there is the whole collaboration aspect of it, the end user side. That's not the conversation I'm having. I'm looking at you as being a developer or deliverer of Web 2.0 kinds of collaboration solutions. What's the common characteristic about that is I've got these vertical stacks of applications I tend to duplicate over and over and over again, right? Everything has a little Apache, MySQL, PHP, or change the component of choice to whatever matches your environment. But you tend to see these little stacks of things. So what happens is these application spaces become like appliances, and I duplicate them as necessary. All right. So in a zoned environment, there turns out to be tremendous synergy by being able to aggressively share all those binaries, all those shared libraries with the resource controls and the security controls, I think that's a pretty compelling way to go do this. Now, where I may walk away on the exception side of this and say, yeah, but, is if those turn out to have kernel dependencies, or they turn out to have other OS dependencies that, oh, by the way, I happen to need this PHP module that only exists here, and I probably, if I concentrate on it real hard, I could probably come up with one of those, and unfortunately, probably not be on my platform, but if one of those things existed, then at that point in time, I'm going to say then, I'll tell you what, the right answer is to bring an entire VM to go solve that because I've got no other way to do this. But if I'm just going to go cookie-cutter out application appliances, and those application appliances tend to be the same thing over and over, this is beginning to look like use case number one. It's just more complex. In that case, then, I like the use of containers for solving that particular problem. But again, the exception is going to be where I begin to see things like kernel dependencies. I kind of walk away from them. And then lastly, this is real hard. Begin to look at development. I'm going to go class as Java development because this brings yet another abstraction of virtualization piece in. So when I look at enterprise application development, there's a very easy decision point that's going to go set this all off, and that's what IDE and OS capabilities are you going to go try to take advantage of. If you think that DTrace is going to solve your problem, or if it's going to give you greater visibility, or it's going to help you turn code faster, then that becomes the decision point, and you leverage zones to go do this. If you are not going to leverage DTrace to go do this, then probably everybody in their own VM environment is a tremendous solution, because if you're not going to take advantage of the advanced feature, then go ahead and cookie cutter out all of those. And again, I go back to use case number two. This begins to look like use case number two, is then I would give everybody their own environments that look like the thing they were going to go develop to, right? So if you're developing a multi-tier application, you get a little bit of database, you get a little bit of an app tier, you get a little bit of presentation tier, and you develop your widget in that particular case. Because what I don't want to do is I don't want to deal with the fact that when I move an application from development to test to production, I start changing its characteristics, and I have to begin to test against those changes as well. The one thing, though, where Zones does create a very interesting new model, though, and this is one where when you always look for opportunities to end difficult staffing conflicts by the reduction of privilege in a non-global zone. Once I put you in a non-global zone, if I can trust that you can't do bad things, I'm going to be more apt to allow you to be the root user in a non-global zone, aren't I? In fact, the reason why I don't allow a developer, typically, and this is a development versus administration kind of conflict, is the reason I don't allow a developer to have user ID 0 is because you're going to do something that's going to affect somebody over there, and so both of you are going to be yelling at me, so therefore I'm just going to make you both mad by saying you can't do it, and I become the broker for that. Well, what zone changes that model, because in a non-global zone, by having a reduced privilege, I already gave you the list and said that you can't hurt other people. If all you can hurt is yourself, then I'm going to allow you to do that because it's easier for me to give you the privilege necessary to do your job, because I can safely look at the system and say, you know what, you can't hurt somebody else over here. And if all you can do is destroy yourself, and if I've got a very, very quick way of reprovisioning you, then go forward with the privilege. And it actually makes my life easier, it makes your developer's life easier, we reduce the conflict, and we progress, we move things forward much, much quicker. So in this case, I actually like both the security model and the DTrace capability kind of lend itself towards the zone implementation. If that's not your particular direction, then this becomes a pure ESX play, and again, ESX provides a very, very unique solution that we want to go take advantage of. Okay. To bring this thing to a conclusion, I'm looking at my time, and I'm about ready to run out. So the conclusion is that consider the Earth a sphere is not a proper approximation for the question at hand. The two technologies are tremendously complementary, and if we want to gain the best advantage of them, we're going to use each one in their strengths. Zones is going to levitate more towards a homogeneous partitioning solution. ESX is going to gravitate more towards a general purpose virtualization solution where I do virtualization through abstraction, and that provides me some tremendous capability. The trick is learning how to use each one where, and hopefully over the last hour we've at least looked at a couple of use cases that might make answering this question a little bit easier. Some references? lots and lots and lots of references. The best place is actually the containers blueprint, which will give a whole lot of backup material for the stuff that we covered very, very early in the conversation. So if you want to go read a little bit more detail in that, the containers blueprint is actually a very well-written document. Also, if you want to participate in the conversation, I welcome all of you to come over to the OpenSolaris.org site, join the Zones Interest discussion list, and bring your questions, bring your suggestions, bring your use cases, and we're certainly there to go help you. And then lastly is for the Web 2.0 kind of use case. One of the things that I noticed the other day when I was looking around is that there is a very interesting set of appliances starting to show up. In this case, these are ESX appliances. And this is great. So this was a web app and a database available as pre-built VMware images. And you're going to see more and more and more of that. We're providing some of them. Our partners are providing some of them. Our customers are beginning to provide some of them. So we're beginning to collaborate and start building very, very useful appliances. So you'll see more and more of this going forward. Question in the back?
Yeah, most of your life, I guess, Solaris and ESX, so it's my life, Solaris, with the hardware.
Yeah, and so, I mean, we charge per the socket. So when you look at the software licensing for Solaris, we charge per the socket. And so I don't know that if we're looking in a mixed environment, I don't know how to address the do we charge at less the number of sockets in the server. I'm assuming we're going to charge the number of sockets in the server. But the number of virtual machines that you have would be completely irrelevant to us. So if you want to run 64 VMs, it's not. I don't see that as 64 instances of Solaris. I see that as one Solaris on 64 sockets. And I believe that's the right answer to that question. We would be a little bit disingenuous if we licensed it differently, since we're suggesting some of our competitors and ISVs kind of move in that direction as well. Cool. All right, so I appreciate you guys' attendance, particularly since it was kind of hard to find this session. If you're looking for these materials, the PDFs for this are going to be available in the collab site for this. Also, I'm going to post speaker notes to, I guess, sun.com/VMware. And I will post speaker notes and other backup material for this as well. Yes, sir. Yes. Yeah. Right, and so the answer is, can I do that? Today I can do that through a manual operation. Solaris 10.11.06 will add zone migration, which will automate all of the processes necessary. So it will detach a zone from one box. I now bring it zone root over to another box, and I reattach it. And what it will do is it will check the packages for consistency, it will check the patch levels, and it will rebuild the device directory, because device numbers don't necessarily have to be in sync, and that's a complexity. So it will do all of those operations, and then that zone will now be running over here. The zone has to be down in order, so this is not like ESX live migration. The zone is not running when you do the migration. But that capability will be there. You can do it manually today. It is available in Solaris 10.11.06.
But the prerequisite for that to work is that it is exactly the same template for both Solaris 1.0.
I think I'm allowing you to have a superset on the system that you're moving to. I can't have a reduced patch set, but you have to at least have those packages and patch levels that I'm running. And I believe for things that I don't care about, I don't look at those. So the use case for that, all right, so the interesting, because you brought up a very, very interesting question, so the use case for that is the one that I call unintended application linkage. And so what I look at is I look at an environment like this. So I've gone to all the trouble to build out my zones like this. And so now here comes, 2 years from now, we've been running very, very happily, and 2 years from now, here comes Solaris 11. I'm making this up. Don't go out. Solaris 11 is coming. I'm using this as an illustration. You're going to go look at each one of these zones. Can I migrate to Solaris 11? Yes or no. Can I migrate? Yes or no. Some of those you are, some of those you're not. So the strategy behind zone migration is, what I'll do is I will probably use something like Live Upgrade to build a clone of this system. I will move its disks over to a new system, and then I will migrate over the workloads, the legacy workloads that are not going to go through the upgrade process, and then I'll apply an upgrade to this box. So the value that zones would bring in this mix is that there's no interesting linkage that would make the moving of that very, very hard, because since you're self-contained and you're unaware of everybody else, I can make those decisions on a zone-by-zone basis. The complexity with that is without zones, then the question comes is, how do I untangle all of this mess to go do the upgrade? And the answer is, not very easily, which is why I don't do that. And then that's why upgrades take so long to run through an infrastructure, because untangling applications to do it effectively is very, very difficult.
So, along those same lines,
yeah, and so that's one of those where the answer isn't necessarily one that makes an awful lot of sense, because once the deployment is done, is there really any difference? I've gone in after the fact and taken a sparse root zone, copied the directories, and you know, nothing hurts the process. But I wasn't calling 1-800-USA for Sun for help either. So right now the answer is no. Once that decision I make early on, and I can't change that, so the sparse versus whole root, I make that early on. Perhaps that's worthy of reconsideration, so if that's something that we think is a useful use case, right now we don't. That would be something that would be very useful to discuss on the zone's interest discussion list, and if there are more people who think that's interesting, then maybe we need to go back and reevaluate that. Because there's no real technical challenge other than installation that would make that not happen, right? So, we just don't think that's... Let's pursue your question even in a more odd case, because one of the things that we can do with zone migration that's really scratching our head is I can migrate a zone from a Spark box to an x86 box. The question becomes, is there a reason to do that? Is there a reason to do that? Well, if you look at it, I inherit package store, I'm getting all my binaries from the global zone. If there are no binaries in my non-global zone, then won't my applications over here kind of work the exact same way? And particularly in a Java world, where all I have to do is bring the JVM over. So that's another interesting use case that we're trying to figure out. We've built the technology, now people are going to use this. So I don't even particularly care if you move from an x86 to a Spark machine, although I question the sense of that. Now, this is an area where ZFS actually helps us tremendously too, because in a ZFS world, ZFS is endian neutral, which means that I can also bring the file system with it. What's that? Yeah. No. Oh, absolutely.
Well, first,
yeah. It's Rev 1.0 of any technology, and you know, there's an awful lot of hype and a lot of expectations that are up. No, it's a tremendous file system, but from the sense of endian neutrality, absolutely. And the way it works is that you, as the writer, get to choose the endianness. And me as a reader, I've got the responsibility of adapting the endianness. So it is an endian neutral file system, and that part has no issue. It does get a little bit more interesting in 1106 when hot sparing actually works like it's supposed to, and like a double bit parity protection, it gets a little more interesting. But no, ZFS is cool. But ZFS in this case is interesting because now I can also move the file systems with the zones, which is something that would be a little bit difficult to do today. Does that make sense? That's one of those where I'm trying to wrestle with the use case. We're taking a Spark to x86. In a grid environment, I can kind of see it a little bit, but I'm wrestling with that as an interesting value. SunMC would be kind of the core. So if you look, so what's the correspondence to something like VM Center would be the N1 suite, of which particularly of interest here would be SunMC, which has a container module, a graphical container module for the creation, management, and displaying what's happening. And that would be a way to go graphically manage all of these. In addition to support the open source community, we've also developed a WebMin module. So if you're a heterogeneous environment and want to support this on multiple platforms, I've got a WebMin module that does many of the same things that SunMC does. It's also very nicely integrated into the provisioning server that is part of the larger N1 product suite. So I would compare VM Center to the N1 product suite, and then within the N1 product suite, specifically the provisioning server and SunMC, are the components that get involved within zones. And they provide similar form and function given the fact that they're solving different problems. And there are things I like about each one. Yes, sir?
Is the memory control moved out of the realm of providing a project for the non-global loan to the actual investment we've been talking about for a long time, and I'll have to move that out of the project realm and into the actual project and control out of the realm of it being something that you really want to work effectively and to find in your non-global loan. Which, if you ever gave someone access to the whole loan, they could just kind of choose themselves, whatever they want.
All right, so right now, so our cap demon right now, our cap demon is a project limit, and we do it by enforcement by project limits. And so what we've tried to do is, because a zone can be labeled with a project, then therefore the zone inherits the limit, and that's really the approach that's been taken there. So in that respect, if I get to the global zone, then you know all bets are off. I can do denial of service tax in the global zone, which is why you don't run applications that typically allow users to go do things in the global zone. So Solaris 10602 added most of those controls. And so RCAP daemon is there, and I can go assign essentially a project to a zone, and now I can apply an RCAP limit against that project and control the physical memory usage by zone.
Whereas the project system will
the
non-global zone the global zone is final limit
on the project. Right. On the project. Right, I define the project limit, and that project is mapped one-to-one and onto for that non-global zone. So you kind of accomplish it. It doesn't look like a zone limit, it's a project limit, but that project limit happens to apply to that zone. And I suppose you could have multiple zones against that project, although I don't know that would be a recommended case. Correct, and 602 changed that, because now I've got RCAP-D and I can apply that limit. Some things that we're adding to the mix is we're also going to do swap reservations as well, so I'm going to limit swap reservations. So that will be coming. So that's kind of the next thing. I guess, so they're telling me to stop, so...
Yeah.
For the purpose of what we're here, so thank you all, and I'll stick around. We'll continue our conversation here kind of privately. So again, thank you all for your attendance.